Good morning, and thank you for remembering to change your clock. Actually, I don't know if anyone changes their clock anymore. Right? The clocks pretty much change on their own at this stage. Welcome to another in the Legal Ethics series, the first one actually for 2019. Our topic is Sue or Settle, Promoting Compromise. I want to thank the Bayit for once again making the space available, as well as printing the copies. Let's not forget that. Please make sure that you sign in. Where are the sign-in sheets at this point? There are three of them. Okay, so there are sign-in sheets there, particularly if you want credit. Yeah, but also for follow-up. I already noted one thing in my notes, but when we get to it, I'll mention it, that I want to send out afterwards as a follow-up item. So please make sure that you're signed in. As always, what I'm saying is neither legal advice nor psak, nor a rendering of Jewish law. Please make sure that for practical questions, you either approach appropriate counsel or your shul rabbi, but this should not be taken as practical guidance. And finally, our next session, by popular demand, is a session that qualifies for EDI credits, and that will be in May. It's a Monday night in May. I will send out the date, I expect, with the follow-up email, because I don't remember offhand, but it's a Monday evening in May, and it will be at Shari Shamayim. For more than that, again, it'll have to wait until I actually remember what the date is. But that will be in May.
Monday, May 13, you said.
Monday, May 13. Okay.
So what's the topic?
Well done. Thank you. I believe it is racial diversity in the workplace. I believe that's the topic. Okay. So our topic for today, sue or settle, promoting compromise. And there are three parts to this. I want to talk first about comparing the system of compromise in Ontario and Jewish law. Then look at the logic behind each system. And then finally look at the ramifications of the different approaches. So I want to make sure to give credit to two articles and a book, which were very helpful. One, an article by a fellow by the name of Samuel J. Levine in the Journal of Catholic Legal Studies. Another, the work of Robert A. Baruch Bush in the Fordham Urban Law Journal. And that's something that I want to make sure to send out later, because I actually realized I didn't put the credits for the articles on the source sheet. But also local talent, Marvin Huberman's book that came out a couple of years ago or last year, A Practitioner's Guide to Commercial Arbitration, was very helpful for me as well. On the sheet, you see the three questions that I want to ultimately approach. First one, David, a lawyer, is approached by Jonathan, whose neighbor Rhonda damaged his yard by riding her ATV onto the grass. All three of them are Jewish, and the reason I say that all three of them are Jewish is simply because it avoids nuances which I'm not sure how to address in terms of religious obligations for people who are Jewish versus religious obligations on people who are not Jewish. So I figured, let me just avoid that side of things by just saying that they're all Jews in the case. So David is the lawyer. Jonathan and Rhonda are the parties in the case. Jonathan had a fine yard until Rhonda rode her ATV onto the grass. Jonathan attempted to sue Rhonda in religious court. Rhonda refused to participate. The religious court has given Jonathan dispensation to pursue Rhonda in secular court, but David thinks this case is ripe for mediation. Is David obligated, professionally or religiously, to attempt to persuade Jonathan to settle with Rhonda? Does the lawyer have any sort of duty to try to push for mediation? So that's going to be our first case of the three. Again, we're not getting to the cases until we talk theory, so I'm not going to do pros and cons yet, but we'll get back to it. The second case, Ralph was a contracted employee of Susan's construction company before being dismissed without proven cause in the middle of a job. Ralph wants the balance of the salary and benefits on his contract. Susan wants to give him nothing. Julie, the professional arbitrator with whom they have contracted, hears the arguments and feels that Ralph only deserves 10% of what he wants. All three of them are Jewish, again, just to avoid complications in the case. Would professional practice and Jewish law consider such a lopsided result an acceptable settlement? Can you have an acceptable settlement in which one side gets nothing? And then last, Jewish law insists that Jews pursue litigation in religious courts ideally. May Jews pursue arbitration with an arbitrator who is not using any particular system of law to decide the case? Is it okay that you're not dealing with a Beit Din, that you're not dealing with a religious court? So those are the three issues that I want to ultimately deal with after we're done looking at the theory. I'm going to ask people not to pass the sign-in sheet up here, actually, because people are least likely to sign in up here as a general rule. Okay, so introduction. The as a general principle, both systems do seem to be, both the Ontario system and Jewish law, seem to be in favor of settlement without litigation. There are multiple kinds of approaches to achieving a settlement under the general heading of ADR, alternative dispute resolution. Right? What are the types? What are the types of processes one might engage in, or parties might engage in order to reach a settlement? Mediation. That's arbitration. Right. What else? There's more.
Negotiation.
Actually, I put it on the sheet, right? That's number one. Fine. You're going to look at me like, why are you doing this? It's on the sheet. And conciliation. Working it in order, based on the order that I used. Right? Negotiation isn't really anything in terms of a litigation process at all. It's the parties working out the problems themselves. Mediation, the parties work out the problems with the help of a selected intermediary, but fundamentally they come up with the solution. What's the advantage of mediation over litigation?
Cost.
Sorry?
Cost.
That's a big one. What else?
Speed,
potentially.
A certain amount of security.
Meaning?
At least you know what you're going to be getting once you make a decision, as opposed to all or nothing.
Well, you don't know going in, though.
No, don't know going in, but
no, but you know you won't get an outcome you don't want.
Right, because it's not happening unless you consent. Right.
What he said at the end was a fundamental advantage.
Yeah.
Because when you go to court, you either win or you lose. Here, you craft a solution that's a little bit different. You have some say in what the outcome is, even if it's not a home run.
True.
That's the line judges use in a settlement conference. They'll always tell you, you never know what the outcome is going to be, no matter how big your case is. So
right.
At least there you're...
Right. One more element that has...
A skilled mediator.
Sorry?
You have a skilled mediator who has special skills.
Right. You get to choose, right? You get to choose who's going to help you. Yeah.
You can also address more issues in a court. You don't have to just follow the one issue that's being played. Many other issues.
Right, you can deal with broader interests and issues that are involved. One more element is privacy. Right, you're not in the public record necessarily, so that's another element that that provides the advantage. Of course, the advantage over negotiation is that you have a professional involved, and hopefully that's an advantage. Then you have conciliation. And conciliation, a lot like mediation, except the intermediary is the one to suggest the solution. Instead of the parties coming up with what they think works, guided by the mediator, the intermediary suggests a solution, and that can be advantageous. It's less, certainly if you're dealing with an acrimonious situation, it's less about what the other guy said. Right, and more about what an intermediary said. The intermediary is presumed not to be biased, and therefore you're more likely to be willing to accept what the intermediary says. And then you have arbitration. Right, so arbitration of these is the most like litigation in the sense that you have the individual arbitrator, panel of arbitrators who hear the arguments and propose a solution, which is then binding on the participants, assuming we're talking about binding arbitration as opposed to non-binding. What's the advantage over mediation or conciliation?
You know you're going to reach it.
Right. It's final. That's a where the parties can't manage it together. You have an outside party impose a solution which they have already agreed beforehand that they're going to accept. But there are some key differences between this and litigation. Right. What are the differences between the arbitration and litigation? Yeah. Right. So you have a very limited. It's not true that you can't appeal, but it's you have a very limited right of appeal. We'll talk later about whether there are options of appealing. Again, we'll talk about the ability to appeal because there are ways in which one can appeal an arbitration decision. But as a general principle, right, there's a very limited right of appeal. It's also different because you get to choose your arbitrator, right? Again, it's not like you're going to court. You may choose an arbitrator who has a particular skill set, which is useful for the case at hand. You're also not bound to a particular legal system, right? It could be done based on the arbitrator's own sense. It could be based on whatever you choose. And again, you have the privacy advantage involved in staying out of the court system. In Marvin Haberman's book, there's also something else called MedArb. I'm not going into that as well. But those are your basic types. So you know, as we said, Ontario likes settlement. Historically, there was a lot of debate as to whether one should or should not pursue settlement. I actually saw an article that I want to send out after the class as part of my follow up. I think it was Michael Bendel who sent it to me by Justice Warren Winkler on pros and cons of settlement. What you have here is actually taken from two American articles that I felt adequately illustrated the points on both sides of the debate. The first one, against settlement, which is actually the title of the article from the Yale Law Journal, does a pretty good job of running through the reasons not to pursue settlement. If you take a look at source number two, the advocates of ADR are led to support such measures and to exalt the idea of settlement more generally because they view adjudication as a process to resolve disputes. That's the way they look at the purpose of litigation. The goal of going to court is there's a dispute between parties and we want to resolve it, which on the whole sounds reasonable. They act as though courts arose to resolve quarrels between neighbors who had reached an impasse and turned to a stranger for help. Courts are seen as an institutionalization of the stranger, and adjudication is viewed as the process by which the stranger exercises power. But Owen Fisk, the writer, says not necessarily. I do not believe that settlement as a generic practice is preferable to judgment or should be institutionalized on a wholesale and indiscriminate basis. It should be treated instead as a highly problematic technique for streamlining dockets. Settlement is, for me, the civil analog of plea bargaining. Consent is often coerced. The bargain may be struck by someone without authority. The absence of a trial and judgment renders subsequent judicial involvement troublesome. And although dockets are trimmed, justice may not be done. Like plea bargaining, settlement is a capitulation to the conditions of mass society and should be neither encouraged nor praised. He's not happy, right? What are his objections here? Saying it in other words?
It's rarely justice in the settlement. Just to save the court's time.
His fundamental objection is that the court system is about more than this party wants this, that party wants that, we need to make the problem go away, and here's a speedy way to do it. If that were really what justice was all about, just let's, you know, end this dispute, he says, then fine. But he says what you end up with is something that violates the real principles that are involved when you are pursuing justice. He says you end up with coercion of consent within the process, and that's something that I don't know is necessarily built into the process, but he's arguing that it happens. He says you're fundamentally dealing with a mediator or an arbitrator to whom you have given authority. They don't have authority by dint of society. You didn't have a trial, you didn't have judgment. Any further pursuit, as in appeal, for example, is going to be very difficult. And it's not just. You aren't really achieving justice. He continues in number three. He says, of course, imbalances of power can distort judgment as well. We count, however, on the guiding presence of the judge, who can employ a number of measures to lessen the impact of distributional inequalities. In other words, he's saying in courts you could also end up with lack of justice. You have one party who's more powerful than the other. One party is able to get a really good lawyer and the other party is not. You will have imbalances of power in the courtroom too. But he says that's what you rely on the judge to take care of. He can, for example, supplement the party's presentations by asking questions, calling his own witnesses, inviting other persons and institutions to participate. There are other ways that a judge is able to balance things out in a courtroom. And that's very important to him. And then finally, in number four, in my view, however, the purpose of adjudication should be understood in broader terms. Adjudication uses public resources, employs not strangers chosen by the parties, but public officials chosen by a process in which the public participates. These officials, like members of the legislative and executive branches, possess a power that has been defined and conferred by public law, not by private agreement. Their job is not to maximize the ends of private parties, nor simply to secure the peace, but to explicate and give force to the values embodied in authoritative texts, constitutions, statutes, and so on. So the points he's making are good points, right? What he's saying makes a lot of sense. So why is it that, as I suggested in the beginning, and as we're going to see, in Ontario we favor going for settlements? It is in fact enshrined in the rules of civil procedure. Why is that? If the points that he's making are valid points. Yeah,
I think it's back to his statement that it's a docket clearing process more than it is a justice seeking process.
So it's a matter of practicality.
All the points that lead up to settlement should have taken place before you get into the dispute going to court or arbitration or wherever you're going. In other words, one presumes they tried to settle before they got there. Then they're saying you have to do it again.
Okay. I hear that. Yes.
I think something else. The difference is if you go to court, you can appeal.
Right.
So if you don't like the judge or there's something wrong, you have to appeal.
Yeah.
If you do an arbitration or any other matter, once you settle, it's over. There's no appeal. There's no position.
Is that an advantage or a disadvantage?
I think it's an advantage to be able to appeal.
That depends on which side of the verdict you expect to be on, right?
But I'm saying at least the fairness of the judge. If there's something that's not fair, you have grounds to appeal.
Right. Which
in the other case, there's no grounds whatsoever.
Right. We have more chairs up here, by the way. Sorry? We have more chairs up here because I see someone standing in the back.
Very good bunch of grounds to appeal.
Yeah.
So I can only talk from a commercial real estate aspect. I tell clients, if you have 100% case, you have 100% chance of winning, if you don't have 100% case. The idea that you can get justice is, I would say, remote. You have a family law judge, the Supreme Court is called commercial courts, very restricted to certain areas, but they don't cover real estate. You have a judge who did family law with a wife, and his wife, and knows very little about real estate. But we had a case where we thought was 100% case. We got a commercial judge who was retired sitting in for judges, so we thought, this is slam dunk. He made a decision. I had no idea what it was like. We appealed it and we won, but that's not the point. I'd rather take my chances on arbitration because it's cost effective, less trying on the phone, etc. I think that's why they came back.
So there's a practical consideration. Okay.
A lot of the issues are not really issues that the law addresses. Obviously, in my practice, it's mostly quantum. And, quantum has arguments on both sides of it. It's not something there's really a law about.
I don't actually know what that means.
We say quantum.
How much
the amount of damage.
Okay.
How much something's worth.
Okay.
Non-liquidated damages, so you don't have a contract with a dollar amount that was or wasn't paid. You're trying to evaluate someone's injuries. It's not really a matter of law.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a matter of arguments and experts and things like that.
So therefore you don't need a courtroom.
Well, therefore court is not necessarily
right.
More useful than an arbitration. I have my problems with mediation because I do think there's a power imbalance that is not addressed. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Okay. So all of these are valid points, and they sound to me like practical considerations in favor of working with a settlement system that may well be imperfect. Take a look at number 5, please. This is the opposing article. The response for reconciliation. Andrew McThenia and Thomas Schaffer. Many advocates of ADR make efficiency-based claims, and a plea for ending the so-called litigation explosion and for returning to law and order runs through the rules of procedure branch of the ADR literature. But the movement, if it is even appropriate to call it a single movement, is too varied for Fiss's description, flipping the page. Fiss's description of traditional dispute resolution is a story of two neighbors, quote, in a state of nature, who each claim a single piece of property and who, when they cannot agree, turn to a stranger to resolve their disputes. That's the way that you end up litigating, right? I wonder if this is a reference to the Talmud in the beginning above Mitzvah, where you have two parties, and one of them says, I found the garment first, and the other one says, I found the garment first, right? They're both holding it. That's what it sounds like, the two strangers in a state of nature who each claim a single piece of property. The soundest and deepest part of the ADR movement does not rest on Fiss's two neighbors model. It rests on values of religion, community, and workplace that are more vigorous than Fiss thinks. In many, in fact, most of the cultural traditions that argue for ADR, settlement is neither an avoidance mechanism nor a truce. Settlement is a process of reconciliation in which the anger of broken relationships is to be confronted rather than avoided, and in which healing demands not a truce, but confrontation. Instead of, quote, trivializing the remedial process, settlement exalts that process. Instead of reducing the social function to one of resolving private disputes, settlement calls on substantive community values. This paints it very differently, right? Now it's a philosophical issue of which way you want to go. And I want to come back to that and explore that more. There's quite a bit to be said for this. I'm just not there yet. In practice, Ontario's rules of civil procedure are definitely in favor of negotiated settlements. Going back to the 1970s, you had the requirement for a pretrial meeting with the judge or with another judge to solve or simplify the issue. If you take a look at source number 6, rule 50 from the rules of civil procedure governs this. The purpose of this rule is to provide an opportunity for any or all of the issues in a proceeding to be settled without a hearing, and with respect to any issues that are not settled, to obtain from the court orders or directions to assist in the just, most expeditious, and least expensive disposition of the proceeding, including orders or directions to ensure that any hearing proceeds in an orderly and efficient manner. So you're going to have your pretrial meeting that's supposed to help along these lines. And then beginning in 1999 as an experiment, and then enshrined in law as of 2002, you find mandatory mediation for civil suits other than certain types of cases like family law cases, in which the parties are able to select from a list of mediators or one is going to be appointed for them. And I brought you rule 24.1 in source number 7, which says this rule provides for mandatory mediation in specified actions in order to reduce cost, delay in litigation, and to facilitate the early and fair resolution of disputes. The lawyer is also supposed to act as a filter, right? The lawyer is also supposed to help them achieve this. On the one hand, we say, and I brought it in number 8 from the LSO's Rules of Professional Conduct, a lawyer shall represent the client resolutely and honorably within the limits of the law while treating the tribunal with candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. But that wasn't actually what I was looking for from the...
It's number 9 you're looking.
No, number 9 is... I do want to get to number 9, but I thought that I had brought in number 8... Yeah, no, I brought the wrong one in number 8. What I wanted in number 8 was the requirement to zealously advocate on behalf of your client. That was what I was expecting to bring there. It's nice to have candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. I'm not arguing with those. But there's also an obligation to zealously represent the client that I thought I was bringing there. I trust that people are familiar with that. But at the same time, in number 9, we are told a lawyer shall advise and encourage the client to compromise or settle a dispute whenever it is possible to do so on a reasonable basis, and shall discourage the client from commencing or continuing useless legal proceedings. How would you define reasonable basis?
However you want.
No, in all seriousness. Sorry?
Settlement?
No, but what is when you say settle a dispute whenever it is possible to do so on a reasonable basis?
You take the amount at issue times the chance of being successful in court.
Right. You're going
to
say
this? So risk analysis.
Right.
Right.
I had asked Marvin Huberman this, and he answered me, best interest of the client, which, of course, is a big place because it involves many different factors. But I think that's a reasonable definition, best interest of the client. How would you define useless legal proceedings?
When people are using the legal system to address their feelings rather than the issues that are actually going to be dealt with in the lawsuit.
Yeah.
If you don't get paid.
Yeah. Yes.
But it's not contextual.
Yes.
It's useless for someone, it may not be useless for something else. For example, if you're involved in litigation as non-commercial, for example, it's administrative litigation, there may be a legitimate interest by the client to delay certain outcome.
Right.
And he knows he's going to lose. Like, he's just delaying.
Right. Right. I mean, there are different definitions you can give, but fundamentally, a case that is without merit in its own right is what we're talking about. Now,
there are some cases where certain lawyers, either because of the litigation strategy or because of the temperament of the client, engage in a scorched earth policy. They know that they can attrition the other side into submission. I think that's what the rules are trying to address. And if you take a look at the cost awards, when it finally gets heard, the judges will try to stamp that out.
Mm-hmm. This is true. Yes?
I just wanted to ask a question, whether or not 50.1, it says the purpose of the rules is to provide an opportunity for any or all of the issues in a proceeding to settle without a hearing.
Right.
Saying without a hearing before the court.
Correct.
Because my understanding is usually what happens in is that the minutes of the mediation or the arbitration, etc., whatever happened before, usually it will be brought to the court, and it ultimately later on, and they'll say.
No.
You tried to resolve.
I think you specifically can't, right? Isn't there
under Rule 7, if there's a minor, you've got to get it approved. Under Rule 7, if there's a minor or a person under disability, the minutes of settlement have to be approved by the court. Otherwise, the thing's just dismissed. They don't see the minutes of settlement.
So if you have a mediation,
you're not allowed to.
Right.
Anything that goes on mediation,
that was what I was under.
Anything that goes on in mediation is confidential. It doesn't come before the court at all.
Right.
Unless it's under Rule 7 with the person.
That's not the right. But that's
in terms of approving the agreement.
If there's not an agreement reached in mediation, you can't then go to the court and say we tried to settle. And therefore,
the whole point of settlement
terms, right.
The whole point.
Mediation,
right. I'm going to move forward with this. One last note, and I thank Moshe Rand for noting this in an email to me. Is that lawyers may actually be able to withdraw from representation, withdraw from the record, because the client refuses their advice to settle. There's a possibility of loss of confidence there because the advice is not being followed. And the lawyer, there's a lot of literature in the U.S. That I saw about it. I couldn't find as much in Canada, but it does seem to fit, even though there are all sorts of rules about when and how one may withdraw from representation, this may well be grounds. This is all about Ontario. Let's shift gears and talk Jewish law. Judaism has the same debate about litigation versus settlement. If you take a look at source number 10 on your sheets, this is the key passage in the Talmud with this discussion. There are two terms that are used apparently interchangeably in the Talmud to describe the process of coming up with a settlement. One is called pshara, and the other one is called bitsua. And for our purposes, they're essentially the same, even though their meaning really is different. there should be a difference. But for our purposes, as we read through this, you don't really see a difference. Bitsua means what?
Splitter.
To split, right? It's to split. Bitsia dapat is cutting the bread. For example, bitsia is, or bitsua, is splitting. And it suggests that there's something in the middle, some pot in the middle, and the parties are going to split it. This one is going to take this, and that one is going to take that. The other term, pshara, is a different sort of a term. What does pshara mean?
Solution
can be compromised, but where does it come from? Lukewarm. Good. It comes from lukewarm. Mayim poshrin is lukewarm water. It suggests that one side wants it hot, one side wants it cold, and they're going to end up with something that is in the middle. It may well be connected with the word pitaron in Hebrew, the shin and the tav switching. And pitaron is indeed solution in Hebrew, but it comes from this idea that you are meeting in the middle. As I said, as we read through the passage here, it's not going to make a difference. But we find three different views in the Talmud regarding whether a religious court should pursue pshara, bitsua, compromise, settlement, whatever term you want to put on it. Take a look, please, at number 10. First view. Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, Rabbi Yossi of the Galil, said the following, and I'm reading out my English translation as opposed to the original Hebrew just because we're half an hour in at this point. He said, splitting, meaning pursuing a settlement, is prohibited. Not that the parties can't do so, but that the judge is not allowed to say, I want you to pursue a compromise, a settlement, and one who splits is a sinner. Rather, let the law pierce the mountain. Yikov adin esahar. Where do you get that from? Because there's a biblical verse, Ki hamishpat le'elokim hu, justice is for God. Meaning, this is a divine value. The value of justice. If you are going to say, this person may have a right to this, this person may have a right to that, but I want you to get something other than justice, you are in violation of justice. And so Moses would say, let the law pierce the mountain, whereas Aaron, the high priest, Moses' brother, loved peace, pursued peace, made peace between people, quotes a passage from Malachi about pursuing peace. Sounds really positive, but it doesn't want a judge doing it. The judge should not push the parties to try to settle. Flip the page, please. Second view. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, opposite extreme. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha said, it is a mitzvah to split. That's what the judge ought to do. Quotes you a passage in Zechariah, which we're going to have to come back to later, which says, Emet u'mishpat shalom shiftu b'sha'arechem, truth and justice of peace you shall judge in your gates. And the Talmud here, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, is bothered. He says, I don't understand what that sentence means. What is justice of peace? Mishpat shalom. He says, where there is justice, there is no peace. Where there is peace, there is no justice. Yes, I'm aware that that's against what they like to shout at the rallies. Nonetheless, he says, where there is justice, there is no peace. Meaning, if you're going to practice justice, somebody's not going to be happy. Somebody is going to be upset. If you're going to make everybody happy, it's going to be unjust. So he says, what are you talking about? What is this mishpat shalom? What is justice that includes peace? The answer is that's called splitting it, making a compromise that satisfies the desires of justice, and it also satisfies the desires of peace. And so, regarding King David, he quotes you a verse that David performed, Mishpat utzdakah, justice and tzedakah. And tzedakah, as it's understood here, does not mean justice, but rather it means helping somebody out. When we think of tzedakah as a term for philanthropy, it's an attempt to benefit others. And he says again, where there is justice, then you're not trying to help a party. It's not tzedakah. Where there is tzedakah, there is no justice. But the answer is, this is referring to splitting. So we have two opposing poles. You have one view that says, absolutely not, you're not allowed to do it. We have an opposing view that says it is permissible to do it. Not just permissible, but it is actually an ideal. This is what one should do. And then you have an intermediate position. Rabbi Shimon, son of Manasseh, said, when two parties come before you for judgment, then before you hear their words, right, until the judge has actually heard the case, or after hearing, but before you know where the verdict leans, you may tell them, go split. Once you have heard their words and you know where the verdict leans, you may not tell them, go split. As Proverbs says, Mishlei says, like freeing water is the start of litigation. Before the quarrel is exposed, abandon it. Abandon it before the quarrel is exposed, but once it's exposed, that's it. What's this a debate about? Why do I have three different views in the Talmud about whether it's good to pursue settlement? What are they arguing about?
They seem to be arguing about the appropriate role of the judge.
Yeah, meaning?
Well, either one view is a judge should always just pursue justice, and
right.
Settlement is for the parties. Another says, no, that settlement is a kind of justice, right? And the third one is settlement is a kind of justice. Well, not settlement, but the other one is settlement is neither just nor unjust, but it's good. And so until you get to the point where justice takes over, you let them. You can help them settle.
Right.
Right.
You can frame this on two levels. Yeah.
Well, you have competing value. You have values. You have the value of there being justice, and I think something was alluded to earlier in those two opposing articles, development of case law, development of the justice system, and then you have what makes for a peaceful and pleasant society. And compromise is better for peace, but it does not necessarily result in justice. Justice is better for the ideals of society, but as you say, somebody's going to be unhappy when they walk out of that courtroom.
Right. So actually, I'm hearing two different things within what you're saying, and I think they're both potentially right. One way you can look at this is that it's a simple framing of justice versus practicality, and peace being an element of practicality. Saying that it's not about values as much as it's about does society win by pursuing this approach. The other way you can look at it, though, is as a narrower or broader version of justice, and I want to come back to that in a bit. In practice, in Jewish law, we end up as we do in Ontario law. Take a look, please, at source number 11. The ruling of Rabbi Moses Maimonides, which is also brought in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, in the same language. He says, it is a mitzvah to say to the litigants first, do you want law or balancing? If they want balancing, we do that between them. Any court that perpetually practices balancing, if you always pursue the compromise, that is praiseworthy. When is this true? Before the verdict. Even though they've heard, they, the judges, have heard the litigants' words and know in which direction the law leans, there is a mitzvah to split. But after the conclusion of the verdict, when they have said, you're innocent, you're liable, the judge may not balance between them, but the law must pierce the mountain. Until you actually have issued a ruling, the judge is indeed supposed to pursue compromise. He's supposed to take care of this. Now, I should note that this is, first of all, we're taking the lawyer out of the picture in this in this material, because you don't have a formal lawyer position in a religious court, even though you always had, going back to Talmudic times, you had people who would show up and argue on behalf of litigants within a case. You may even have had somebody who was assigned the rights to the case by one of the parties. It wasn't a formal position in court, and therefore you aren't going to find a statement of lawyers have to get the client to pursue settlement. But what you do see here is that the mandate is to try to pursue pshara. The mandate is to try to pursue compromise. Yeah.
Something interesting. In Canadian law, especially in Ontario for sure, when you do a litigation case, it goes to pretrial first.
Yeah.
The judge reviews all the material and suggests whether it should be settled or not.
Right.
It itself is basically like this. The judge, even though he can't make a decision, will suggest from one party or the other, based on what he's saying, you're going to lose. So therefore, either mediate or come to a conclusion.
Yes, except there's one way in which this is different, and I think different on a substantive level, which is who is the one who is doing the mediation slash arbitration here?
No, you're going to find the judge.
It's the judge who's doing
but
it.
But there it's also a judge.
Yeah,
but it's
pre-trial.
Right, but at the pre-trial, does the judge actually try to come to a settlement or simply recommend that they go to?
No, they try to get to a settlement.
Often they will try, but it can't be the judge who's going to hear the case.
Right, exactly.
Right. Well, that's for sure, that it can't be the same one. Yeah, here, this is all going on in the same courtroom by the same judge who is going to hear the case later.
There in pretrial.
Right.
We'll try to get a settlement.
Right.
A settlement
there. Does this sound like binding arbitration or non-binding arbitration?
Arbitration at all.
Well, assuming that the judge is going to be the one who's going to hear it.
Talking about at the basin?
Yeah, at the basin.
Sounds like a med arb.
It's non-binding until they give the judgment.
It's non-binding until he gives the judgment.
He's not arbitrating. The parties can insist they're going to a proper
right,
trial.
But if the judge says to them, right, I read the Talmud, and then I read Maimonides, and he told me that I'm supposed to try to bring you to settlement. So here's what I think ought to happen. Right, because that is what we're talking about. It's not really about mediation. It's really arbitration. The judge is going to say, here's what I think ought to be a decision that won't be justice. This isn't going to be you're right, you're wrong. Rather, it's going to be, I'm giving you this because I think this is what you deserve. Is it binding? So take a look at source number 12, please. Because this clarifies that issue. Part of the same passage in the Talmud. Bitsua Bishlosha Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says when you engage in this splitting, when you engage in settlement, you need three judges. That's Rabbi Meir's position. The sages say, no, you could have one judge. You don't need to have a full rabbinical court in order to do it. Why is there a debate? Because one view believes that we link balancing and justice. We say that it's a court proceeding, and therefore you have to have three judges, just like a court proceeding should. And the other view says, no, it's a separate entity. But then look, Rav Ashi said, we see from here that balancing does not require an act of kinyan. What is he talking about? An act of kinyan means a formal act of transaction, an act which demonstrates that the parties have accepted whatever it is that's being done, and it can be performed theoretically before the judge hears the case and comes up with a decision, or it can be performed afterwards, but it's what obligates the parties to follow the judge's recommendation. That's what kinyan is. So Rav Ashi says, I think you don't require an act of kinyan here. Why? Because if kinyan were needed, then why would we need three judges? Two would suffice with a kinyan. Meaning, he says, once you're telling me you need three judges, that already gives the arbitration the power of a court. And therefore, it doesn't matter whether you performed an act that demonstrated that you intend to follow their instructions. You have to. You're bound to follow what a court says. So if you're telling me you need three judges, this is a court proceeding, and therefore it is binding, whether you make an act of kinyan or not. And then we continue to say the law is that balancing does require a kinyan because you don't require three judges. It requires a kinyan, and therefore the determination of whether it's binding or not all hinges on whether and when you perform the act of kinyan. In the event that you agree, I am going to follow beforehand, then it's binding arbitration. In the event that you don't, then it is non-binding arbitration. It's really as straightforward as that, and whenever your kinyan takes place, we'll determine the nature of it. It really could be either one. Are we clear?
What is the essence of kinyan here? I don't get it.
You're asking how it's executed, or you're asking what its role is?
No. What is its role here? Is it essentially the agreement of the parties to appoint these judges to settle their case? Is that what
essentially, yes. I wouldn't call it appointing only in the sense that it's not as though they have another option within this courtroom.
Wouldn't it be a commitment to whatever the agreement was? That's what the kinyan is. In other words, they're both demonstrating that they are committed, that they've gone through with it. In a civil court, that would be a settlement. In other words,
well,
the judge makes a suggestion. If they both are of one mind about, you know, happy or not, what the settlement is, that is then going to be recorded in the minutes of settlement, which makes it enforceable. They can't walk out and then say, I changed my mind.
Right, but that's after. What we're suggesting here is it could even be done before. In other words, the judge says to them, I think you should settle. They perform kinyan, that then makes it enforceable. They're now bound to follow whatever the judge decides.
So it's signed an arbitration agreement.
Yes, it's an arbitration agreement. Correct.
Judge is going to be acting as an arbitrator.
Correct.
Rather than a judge.
Correct.
So in a sense, you could say he's applying equity he's in a sense taking equitable jurisdiction rather than legal jurisdiction.
Yes. Yes.
He's kind of a hybrid.
Okay. So let's go back to the question of why we prefer settlements, because here I think we get an important insight courtesy of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. In Ontario, we already noted, you know, the FIS arguments against and the McThenia arguments for, but as a general principle in Ontario, we favor settlements for the pragmatic reasons that were mentioned in the beginning. Whether it's speed, whether it's cost, whether it's privacy, whether it's the ability to choose how and what is going to be considered as part of the process or who is going to be the one to consider it. Take a look at number 13 as an example of this. From the Sable case. Settlements allow parties to reach a mutually acceptable resolution to the dispute without prolonging the personal and public expense and time involved in litigation. The benefits of settlement were summarized in Sparling v. Southam. The courts consistently favor the settlement of lawsuits in general. To put it another way, there is an overriding public interest in favor of settlement. This policy promotes the interests of litigants generally by saving them the expense of trial of disputed issues, and it reduces the strain upon an already overburdened provincial court system. This is just the best way to deal with things on a practical level. Don't give me your philosophy. It's not about that. It's not about two strangers existing in a state of nature. This is simply about the best way to make sure that cases are going to be heard and resolved with a minimum of trouble and expense and time. That really seems to be the stance. In Judaism, you find a significant strain that supports that idea and takes the view that, to use the language of Jewish law, settlement is bidyeved. Bidyeved literally means ex post facto. It means once something has already happened, fine. But it's used in a colloquial way to mean something that we do because we're stuck. We don't really have a better option, so fine, we're gonna do things this way. That's the term bidyeved, and that's what you find in many sources as the justification for promoting settlement. But they don't talk about it in terms of cost, and they don't talk about it in terms of time. The practical value that the literature emphasizes is peace. We want people to be able to get along. And the feeling is that you are more likely to get along if you have a more nuanced conclusion than the judge saying, you win, you lose. If you take a look at source number 14, the Hebrew is at the bottom of one side, English at the top of the next side. Until the verdict is concluded, the judge may impose balancing among them, even when he knows which way the verdict leans, right? That was our result of our discussion in the Talmud. But after the conclusion of the verdict, when he has said, you are innocent, you are liable, the judge may not balance between them. But it appears to me, he says, that all of this is said only when the judges wish to impose balancing among them without the agreement of the litigants. If you're going to impose it, then that's your limitation. However, where they inform the litigants of the nature of the balancing, meaning presenting a proposal, they actually say, here's what I would like to do, and persuade them until one forgives the other or gives the other an identified sum, even after the conclusion of the verdict, it is appropriate to do this. Don't say you can't pursue peace between parties because you issued a verdict. Even after the verdict, you can. You just can't impose it. The only requirement is there be no compulsion in the matter, only persuasion. This is a great mitzvah, bringing peace between parties. This was Aaron's practice, loving peace. So the emphasis is, ultimately, as we saw, frankly, in the Talmud that we cited before, and as we see here, there is an imperative of peace. It is applicable during the trial, and it is applicable even after the verdict is in. That's the practical concern that we have. Social peace. But it's not the only consideration that's brought to bear. There's a surprising consideration, or surprising for me, in source number 15, source number 16. Take a look at this from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law. A judge may practice law in the manner of balancing where the matter cannot be clarified. If you can't do a good job, right, in terms of justice, then you should try to promote settlement. Take a look at number 16. Judges must distance themselves with all of their strength from accepting that they will judge by the law of Torah. They have to avoid trying to deal with things as law and push instead for settlement. Don't let the litigants make you handle cases by law. Let them, you know, try to encourage settlement. Why? Take a look at number 17, and then I'll take you in. In the days of Shimon ben Shetach, this is a passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. In the days of Shimon ben Shetach, the right to judge financial cases was removed, parentheses, by decree of the Roman government. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said, "Thank God, for we are not wise enough to judge." Shimon ben Shetach, you're going back to 2nd century before the Common Era. Maybe 1st century before the Common Era, there's some discussion about that. But the Romans are in charge. They took away from Jewish courts the right to handle financial cases. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, living later than that, but viewing it in retrospect, says, that's a good thing, because you know what? We're not smart enough.
Maybe they should get some of our judges to read this.
We can't handle the cases. We don't know what to do. And therefore, it's a good thing we're just encouraging parties to settle. Yes?
In a more nuanced discussion, splitting or balancing encourage more people that don't have a case to litigate.
Doesn't splitting or balancing encourage people who don't have a case to litigate? Because now they'll be pushed in order to get a settlement?
You know, I'll get something. So I'm not doing anything, but you know, if
you're entitled to zero, but if you ask for 100,000, you'll get something.
So good. I'm going to come back to that question very soon. So hold the thought. Or you can jump ahead. Because it's going to come up in number 23. But the question is a good question. Do you say, well, let me take a chance because otherwise I've got nothing anyway?
It's contrary to peace.
Right. I hear you. We're going to come back to this a little bit later. What I would say right now, before I get to the fact that he could really lose everything, even in a settlement, but even before we get to that, is there's an element of social capital involved here as well. In other words, if you go to the rabbinic court, you know, it's not like the mediation arbitration envisioned in the Ontario system where you have the advantage of privacy. This is public. Everybody's going to know. And so I think there's a price that may come with that, that may, you know, there'll be a stigma if they seem to be frivolous.
That's true on both sides, though. That's true on the justified litigant as well as the non-justified. You may want to make a public point.
True.
Further to number 17, one of the things, I mean, you have to distinguish. There are certain cases that are decided entirely on the law, and even that, of course, there are different opinions about what precedents apply. But if you look at trials, it often hinges on the credibility of the different witnesses. Different people will put forward different versions of the facts. And so basically, the judge has to listen to those people testify and has to decide, as a human lie detector, which one is telling the truth. And the reality is, of course, that nobody can be absolutely confident about that. Ultimately, one party may be lying, and you can't tell. Somebody may just be a very good liar and will succeed right. in a trial based on being a good liar. And so you don't end up with justice. That's really
so it's not only about the inability to apply the law, but the inability also to accurately read the case.
Exactly.
Right. I think that is a piece of it. The Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chaim Michael Epstein, in addressing this point, says the concern is Omek Hadin, the depth of justice. That's the way that he looks at it, which I think can take both elements into consideration. Yes, Rena, you were... somebody.
How often will you encourage...
I can't hear you well. I'm sorry.
How is it that a baking can encourage compromise or settlement before they hear from the other side? Like, why is that a possibility?
I think that's the... I mean, that would be viewed, based on what we've seen already, as the best possibility. They're not, I'm sorry, maybe I should make clear. Not that they're going to propose a solution at this stage, but they're going to ask the sides, would you agree to proceed along settlement lines as opposed to along din lines, along justice? Does that answer the question? Yeah. Yeah, they're not, it's not that they see two people come into court and say, okay, just split it 50-50 and go home. What they're trying to do is get their agreement that they're not going to pursue it along the lines of law. That's really the...
What process is public?
Beit Din is public.
Yes, Beit Din is public.
Okay.
rabbinical courts function, unless you have a specific proceeding, I suppose you could create. But generally speaking, the what's going on is public, yes.
But we have two parties in the dispute, and they come from the best, like here in Toronto.
Right, I think today that's true. I mean, the classic model was that a Beit Din was public, but I think today you're right. They tend to conduct closed proceedings.
And it's definitely not published on Canley afterwards.
That is sometimes true. I say that is sometimes true because Michael Broyd has done quite a bit of work on religious courts. He's dealing in an American setting, but religious courts and how they can make sure that their arbitration conclusions are not overturned in a secular court. And one of the points that he makes, if I remember correctly, is publication of results, publication of your decisions. I think that's considered to be a positive thing. Whether they're redacted, I can't speak to. But Sheldon.
Just to clarify, when you deal with arbitration or compromising, are there halakhic parameters?
What do you mean? Okay, so I'm going to come back to this. This is taking me towards number 23 as well. So we'll get there. We'll be pulled forward magnetically. But we've seen two practical concerns. Concern number one is peace. Concern number two is injustice. If the judges make a mistake, whether because, again, misread of the law or misread of evidence. The third practical consideration that Jewish law would consider is that justice is harsh. If you take a look at source number 18 from Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, this is a fascinating source, particularly for trust and estates people. The Rabbi Cook, in context, is talking about the issue that if you look at Jewish law, biblical Jewish law, inheritance in the case where there are sons and daughters, where there is enough for there to be an inheritance as well as to support the daughters, inheritance goes to the sons. I mean, the land is inherited by the sons, and they have to take care of their sisters. Look at what he has to say here in source number 18, writing to somebody about this. He says, His Honor, the person who wrote to him, should realize that no law or statute in the world could fulfill all of the needs of every individual. Legislated laws, like natural laws, are general, and this is their glory and their strength. The sun emerges with its might, and if it will burn the head of some being, animal, or beast from time to time, this will not cause it to withhold its light and heat for the benefit of all. We sweeten the bitterness of natural law, which sometimes overpowers us, not by removing it, which we cannot and would not do, but by creating artificial solutions which enable us to benefit from their good. So too, in a suitable way, we work when necessary and possible to enter into balancing at the desire of the litigants. This is especially so when justice is too harsh for one side, and certainly when it is too harsh for both sides. For this we say, justice shall you pursue, one for law, one for balancing. Meaning the biblical text that says, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. You shall pursue justice, but he uses the term tzedek twice. As the Talmud explains, once to pursue law and once to pursue settlement. He has a similar idea in number 19, which I'm not going to read aloud. I just brought it because it's another framing that he presents. But his point is to say, what he offers us is that justice, meaning by justice following the letter of the law, is often too harsh for the parties involved. You may have a law which works well for 90% of cases, but for these people here, it's a really bad idea. And so he says that's the role of settlement, that's a role of compromise, is because justice is often too harsh for us. And that's a consideration. And then the last view, which goes back towards the peace idea, in number 20, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin was dealing with not a financial case, but a case in which there was a synagogue in which there were parties who prayed with one edition, and there were parties who prayed with a different edition of the prayers. And so the question was, who's going to win? Who gets to control what the nusach will be? What is going to be the formula for the prayers? And look at his comment here. He says, if the law cannot bring about peace, then they must enact balancing. He's afraid that controversy is going to continue unless you're going to come with some kind of arbitrated solution. Simply imposing the law isn't going to end the strife. So you have practical considerations, and that's the general view within Jewish law, much like within the secular system. However, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik floated a different idea. He said, not necessarily. And I bring you here excerpts from Reflections of the Rav by Rabbi Avram Besdin, who is presenting the view of his mentor, his Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik. He says, the goal in the pursuit of justice within Jewish law, the goal is not really about justice. That's what we've been looking at. The goal is justice, but for practical reasons, we're going to do something different. He says, that's not what's going on. The goal, practically, in Jewish law, is actually peace. The goal is a nuanced recognition of right and wrong that will lead to a peaceful conclusion. That was always the idea, is Rabbi Soloveitchik's formulation. And he says, look back to those two verses that we quoted, that I said we were going to come back to. One verse said, Emet u'mishpat shalom shiftu b'sha'arechem. You should judge truth and justice of peace. So he argues, take a look at source number 21. I'm in the second paragraph of number 21. I'm skipping the first one. Actually, say the first one also. It's one sentence. In Pshara, however, social harmony is the primary concern of the dayan, of the judge. The fine points of the law, the determination of precise facts, are of secondary importance. The goal is not to be juridically astute, but to be socially healing. That's the role of justice, not the role of compromise. That's the role of justice, is to be socially healing. The first verse reads, execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates. Where there is strict adherence to din, to law, there is justice but no shalom, because one of the parties is humiliated and antagonized. The immediate issue is resolved, but the conflict persists with ensuing social discord. He should seek to persuade both parties to retreat from their presumed points of advantages, and he should preach to them about the corrosive personal and social effects of sustained rancor. His responsibility is primarily to enlighten, rather than to render decisions on points of law. The first verse therefore projects the social welfare of society and the happiness of individuals as primary ideals as being truly a higher form of justice. In his mind, the goal is actually social peace. That's what we are going for. And just to carry it through, the second verse that we quoted, which praises King David as pursuing mishpat utzdakah, judgment and tzedakah. Take a look at number 22. He says, the second verse states, and David executed justice and righteousness towards his people. This verse is concerned with the attainment of tzedek, righteousness. In Aristotelian logic, there is a law of contradiction, which states that a thesis and its antithesis cannot both be valid. It follows from this logic that when two litigants present opposing claims, only one can be right. Strict logic demands the application of din, of law, whereby the claim of the righteous party will be vindicated, while the other party will be discredited. The halacha, however, believes that absolute right and wrong can be realized only in heaven. In dealing with imperfect man, we posit that no man is totally wrong or right, and that in the case of the litigants, both are partially right and wrong. The application of din can only take account of obvious surface conditions. It fails to perceive subtleties underneath, which dilute our certainty about the right and wrong of the litigants. Each has some responsibility for the situation and is partially guilty of the misunderstanding, for misleading innuendos, for contributing indirectly to a climate in society which places others at a disadvantage. Strict justice deals with plain facts and salient reality. Real responsibility, however, goes much deeper and is obscured from the scrutiny of the court. Metaphysically, no one is entirely absolved in situations of conflict. He says, don't kid yourself. What you think of as law and strict justice is neither. Well, not neither. It could be law. But it's not strict justice. And that's never the goal. The goal, in actuality, is to bring about peace, not as a practical point, but as a goal. That's, he says, what we're looking for, and therefore you pursue settlement. There was a question here.
You actually answered that question, but I have a follow up.
Okay.
And that is he saying that halakha can't determine behavior in most circumstances?
What do you mean?
Well, halakha doesn't apply because it can't solve peace problem between two litigants, both of whom are partially right and partially wrong.
Well, I would distinguish between din and halakha. Din, meaning the letter of the law on the books. You claim this, the other party claims that, and here is the verdict. Here's who we believe. Here's who's going to win. He's saying that that is not nuanced enough to deal with the situation, which is the same point, really, that Rabbi Cook is suggesting. The difference between the two of them is that the way Rabbi Soloveitchik presents it is that God never wanted you to go to din, because din is a clumsy tool. What he wanted was for the parties to ultimately reconcile with each other, recognizing that on some level each party has a level, has some responsibility.
But in learning halacha, don't you learn in specific cases that apply generally,
yes,
universally?
Yes. And he's arguing that it's a clumsy tool. That fundamentally it isn't going to do. I mean, yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think I understand what you're saying. But his argument is that the law that is found on the books is, yeah, to borrow from the Greeks, right? Aristotle has the notion of a perfect world, a perfect triangle, a perfect shade of green, or whatever it is that exists in some realm somewhere. And all triangles and all shades of green that exist in this world are only reflections of that. So I'm borrowing that idea here. The law that you will find in Choshen Mishpat, the law that says, Ploni says this, Almoni says that, and here's what we do, is an abstraction. But in reality, in the cases that you see that come into the court, that doesn't quite fit. It may be the best we can do, and we'll do it if we have to. But we would prefer to come to a conclusion that actually reconciles the parties to each other, understanding that it's never black and white. That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik is proposing here.
Hang on. It can never be black and white. The party can't be 100%.
See, I was also bothered by that.
I mean, there's a lot of fields of law where one is right and one is wrong.
Right. I was also bothered by that. I have to say, saying that it's never 100% one way and 0% the other is something I'm uncomfortable with, and maybe that's why he adds the phrase here, contributing indirectly to a climate in society which places others at a disadvantage. Now you're really reaching for a way in which one party may in fact be guilty. Even though they look like they're right, yeah, but they contributed to a society. I feel like we're really looking for something very delicate in terms of what one party has done, such that they'll be declared responsible. But those are his words. And Rabbi Bezdin is generally considered a faithful recorder of the ideas of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Michael.
I was bothered by the same thing. I mean, there are certain instances where one party is clear wrong. It doesn't fit the narrative you just read. I mean,
I understand what you're saying.
And the history of the case make it very clear that you know, there's a good guy and a bad guy.
Right. I understand. In the interest of time, recognizing that you're getting 1.5 credits, and not more. So I'm gonna actually go further, because I don't want to hold people past time, and there's quite a bit yet to say. I will pause from time to time still, but I think I need to focus on moving forward with this. Rav Herschel Schechter, close student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, adds a really important point in terms of how this works. And this is source 23, which I kept saying would be relevant to questions that were being asked. He says in Nefesh HaRav, our master, Rabbeinu, our teacher, would explain that balancing is also a legal verdict, meaning this is law. But it is a verdict of transcending the line of the law based on justice. What he's talking about in Hebrew is lifnim mishurat hadin. There is an obligation to act towards others beyond the letter of the law. That's what you're doing. It's based on justice. The law does not say to split the monetary sum in dispute as a means of balancing, but to establish, based on a sense of justice, who is right in this case. Sometimes the verdict of balancing will be 100% opposite what it would have been in law. People are accustomed to say, and so is found in latter-day authorities, that there are two kinds of balancing. There's balancing that is close to law, and there is general balancing. Our master said, meaning Rabbi Soloveitchik, that he did not understand this distinction. The entire matter of balancing is established by the verse, "You shall do that which is just and good." We are always obligated to act according to justice and transcending the line of the law. And if so, this itself is the Torah's law. So he, first of all, he supports the idea. He supports the idea that pursuit of settlement is, in fact, what the Torah wants us to do and is law. It's just what we call lefnim mishurat hadin. It's our obligation to act towards others beyond the expectations of law. But he also notes that you could end up with something which is 100% the opposite of what you would expected by what you would have expected by letter of the law. You can come up with a conclusion that's 100% opposite. And as part of his essay on this, he says one party can get 100% of what they want, the other party can get 0% of what they want. That's why I mentioned it before. There is no guarantee that when you go to settlement, that means you're going to get something. You could come away getting absolutely nothing. And it could be that in that had it gone to a standard trial, you would have gotten something, and that now you go to settlement, you actually get nothing. So you can lose by going to the settlement. You can be worse off than you would have been. So I think that's a point worth considering here. I'm going to come back to his point about the 100% because there's a nuance we have to see. But I think that this disagreement in the Jewish model of those who make the practical argument of pursue peace, maybe you'll get the verdict wrong and so on, and the view that says this actually is justice, I think that explains why there are multiple views about how far a judge should go in promoting settlement. If you take a look at source number 24 and 25, two commentaries to the Code of Jewish Law. One is called the Taz, the other is the Sma'at. The first one presented here, the Taz, Rabbi David Alevi, says, quoting the Maharal of Prague, he says, "Since in the Talmud we read that Rav Huna, the judge, would say, 'Do you want law or do you want balancing?' He'd ask it as a question. It appears one shouldn't pursue balancing so much. Don't push them, just offer the option. You could do this, you could do that." However, Rabbi Yeshua Falk in the Sma, Sefer Mirat Einayim, says no. Number 25, the judge must explain to the litigants that balancing will be better for them. He must speak to their hearts so that they might agree to balancing. This is what Rabbi Caro meant when he said the judge should ask, "Do you want law?" Meaning, you came to us to judge the case. Do you want law specifically or balancing? For it will be appropriate to use balancing. You try to persuade the litigants. So two opposite views. One view says offer the option. The other view says persuade them. Why? I think because the first view says it's only a practical consideration, so make the option available. The other view says no, this is what it's all about, so you should try to persuade them. I think that that's what's going on. In terms of how this now plays out in practice, so in Ontario, the view is that, again, compromise, settlement, is a substitute for justice. So the protocol is any system that will allow them to come to a solution that satisfies them enough to stay out of the courts is good enough. So now we have social justice tribunals. You have a call for what are they called? Administrative monetary penalties, right? For traffic offenses, right? It doesn't really matter as long as we get them out of court, off the docket. The problem is resolved. Everybody goes away. We're good. It's a practical utilitarian approach. And within Judaism as well, you find elements of Jewish law that also seem to view it as something other than justice. Like the fact that we offer them the opportunity, we said before, to approve the proposal. Right? It's not imposed necessarily, bless you. They don't have to do the kinyan beforehand. Like the fact that, as we said before, you could use just one judge. A rabbinical court, if it's a true legal proceeding, has three judges. But if you take a look at source number 26, we find out that, in fact, the general view is you could have a single arbitrator who is going to manage the case. You don't need a panel of three. The fact that they're not bound unless they perform kinyan tells you it's not really viewed as law. However, Rabbi Soloveitchik again makes the counter argument. He says, no, this really is law. And he says, I'll show you that it's law. First of all, take a look at source number 27. The Shulchan Aruch, again, the code of Jewish law, just as the judge is instructed not to warp justice, so he is instructed not to warp the balancing for one over the other. Meaning, yes, it's a settlement, but that doesn't mean you play favorites. That doesn't mean you say, this guy is needy, and therefore I'm going to cut him slack. The prohibitions against warping justice will apply when you're dealing with settlement as well. Further, number 28, the laws of remuneration that apply for judges in court apply for arbitrators as well. Number 28, see Be'er Heitev quoting the Bach that one may accept remuneration for balancing. This is the Pitchei Tshuva, Rabbi Avram Tzvi Hirsch Eisenstadt. And then he quotes his father, author of the work, Panim Meirot. He wrote that the Bach's position that balancing is not included in the principle of just as I act free of charge, you know, I need to explain that outside of the text. I was trying to rush through that, but it's not going to work. We have a principle, the Talmud in Nedarim teaches that there's an obligation that when you perform religious acts, religious duties, you can't charge people for doing so. God says to Moshe, to Moses, just like I taught you Torah free of charge, so too when you serve the people, you have to serve the people free of charge. That's the basic principle that's being invoked here. The Bach, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, writing in the 17th century, said that's not true for arbitration. When you're trying to come to an agreement between the parties, then you're not obligated to act free of charge. The father of the Pitchei Tshuva disagrees. He says, starting with the word since, on the third line in 28, since there's a mitzvah of starting with balancing, meaning trying to get them to pursue a compromise, and should the litigants agree to balancing, it would have the status of law. Therefore, it should be within the rule of just as I act, free of charge, meaning you're not allowed to accept remuneration for arbitration. That's going to really limit the number of people who want to go into arbitration. What we mean here is not to say that they can't get compensation, but it has to be done differently as compensation for their time that they're not using elsewhere, as opposed to payment for the role specifically of being an arbitrator. There are nuances to that, but not for right now. The point is, and Rabbi Soloveitchik quotes this, in order to show you're treating this as justice. It's not a workaround to avoid the justice system. It's a function of the justice system. And I think you can provide added support for that. The fact that we say that the judge, once the judge knows which way the judgment leans, the judge is not allowed to really push this. Yes, they can try to get people to come to a settlement, but that's not really the normal means of pshara, of pursuing arbitration. The fact that the judge is not allowed to push this, once he knows where the judgment leans, suggests this really isn't about justice. Says that it is really about justice. Sorry, the other way around. Once the judge knows which way the judgment leans, right, you're now engaged in the practice of justice. You don't get to warp it by saying, I think I'd like to pursue pshara, to pursue compromise. And the fact that we use the judge as the arbitrator is also indicative of the fact that this is really part of din, part of justice. So to sum up quickly what we've said before we answer our three questions that we started with, it seems fairly clear that Ontario is in favor of settlement for practical reasons, whether that is privacy, whether that is economics, whether that is speed, all of the different reasons that we mentioned before. Judaism has three different views presented Talmudically about how we view settlement. Is it something that should be pushed? Is it something that is a violation of justice? Or is it something somewhere in the middle? We do end up saying that the judges are supposed to push for arbitration, which may be binding, may be non-binding. We do say as well that the parties, that the reason for promoting that may be practicality. Rabbi Soloveitchik argues that it's actually the true meaning of justice. So now we clearly have the answer to question number one, right? Question number one was where the neighbor ran over the neighbor used the ATV right? Rhonda used the ATV on Jonathan's lawn. David thinks that this is ripe for mediation. Should David attempt to persuade Jonathan to settle with Rhonda? From an Ontario perspective, the answer clearly is?
Yes.
You bet. From a Jewish law perspective, the answer is? Yes, I think whether practically or not, I think so. Is it okay to have a lopsided settlement? Is it acceptable to have a lopsided settlement? It depends on how we look at settlement. Right? In Ontario, we have rules, and this goes back to the question of whether you can, in fact, appeal an arbitration agreement. So I brought it for you in 30 and 31. There are indeed possibilities for appealing that something wasn't fair. However, not that the conclusion wasn't fair, that the process wasn't fair. If you take a look at number 30, shifting the paradigm, moving from litigation to arbitration. So flip the page to the second part of it. I'm not going to read out the full source. But some of the factors to be considered are, was there gross inequality in bargaining power? Was there exploitation of a weakness, such as lack of sophistication or education? Are there limitations on remedies? You know, the questions that are being asked are about the process, not about the conclusion. You can't say, I didn't get anything from what I asked, therefore this was a bad result, and therefore I want to appeal. Ditto the Arbitration Act in number 31. The court may set aside an award on any of the following grounds. So one of them is a party entered into the agreement while under a legal incapacity. The applicant was not treated equally and fairly. But again, that's about the process, not about not liking the conclusion. In halacha, on the other hand, the school that says that compromise is viewed as a practical substitute for justice argues that you can't veer too far from what justice would have been. Take a look at source number 32, Shmuel Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer. He says the word pesher, pshara, that we use for settlement is like the word poshrin, lukewarm, neither cold nor hot. We do not have a precise threshold for this, for what you come to as your settlement. But my heart tells me that at least the guilty party should not get away with paying less than 2/3 of the sum. This way it is still close to the law. He doesn't want you to go too far from what justice would have dictated. Whereas,
but we saw he may not know what justice dictated. They may be talking about it before he knows which way the verdict leans. He doesn't have any idea.
No, but once he hears the sides.
In settlement, he hears the sides.
Yeah, in settlement, he hears the sides. He has a sense of what it would have been had this been justice, and then he'll come to some conclusion that the sides can live with, and he shouldn't veer too far. Why? Practical considerations. The issue is, you're trying to make peace within society, and you're trying to stick close to law, and therefore, it's not acceptable for you to go too far away. Rabbi Soloveitchik, on the other hand, is good with the idea of being 100% opposite, because he says, no, this is what justice was meant to pursue at all. Final, concluding point. The third question. Is this an issue of what we call erkaos or erkaot? Are you allowed to pursue arbitration where the arbitrator isn't following a particular code of law, or is that a rejection of Jewish law? Again, we have a principle that says that Jewish litigants are supposed to go to Beit Din. They're supposed to go to a religious court for at least three reasons. Number one, the decision to go to a secular system looks like a renunciation of the Jewish system, saying the Jewish system isn't good, I want something else. I want something that I believe will be more fair, will be better, and that's one problem in its own right. Second problem is that in the event that Jews will stop using the Jewish courts, what will end up happening is you will stifle the development of Jewish law. No one will bother studying it, even. And it's very interesting. Justice Menachem Elon wrote in his Mishpat Ivri, he was a judge on Israel's Supreme Court. So he wrote that if you look at responsa literature that was written in countries where Jews were not allowed to handle financial cases, and you compare it with the responsa literature written in countries where we were allowed to, you see a stark difference. In countries where we were not allowed to handle these cases, the rabbinic literature is what we call pilpul. its analysis to fine points within the Talmudic discussion. Whereas in the other countries where we were allowed to carry out these decisions, you find a flourishing of practical literature dealing with real issues, because they had to. And so it affects the development of Torah. That's a second reason why we're supposed to stick within our own courts.
There's also criticism within the common law of arbitration and mediation, because you don't get the development of precedents that are publicly available.
Good. Okay. I didn't know that, although it makes sense. And then third is that Judaism views the pursuit of justice as a religious act. Right, the Sanhedrin sits in the Beit HaMikdash, sits in the temple, and if you're going to move if you're going to move to secular courts, you're taking what had been religious and taking it out of the realm of mitzvah and turning it into just something that we do between parties for the sake of society's function. So the question then is, would you be allowed to go to an arbitrator? So the answer seems to be that one is able to do so, but I wonder if Rav Soloveitchik might disagree, because he views settlement, again, as the pursuit of justice. So I wonder if Rav Soloveitchik would agree with this, but the general tendency seems to be to accept it. Take a look. In the interest of time, I'm going to jump to source number 35. 33 and 34 provide an adequate basis in their own right, but they're more intricate. 35 from the Chazon Ish is fairly straightforward. He says, even though the community has no judge to adjudicate via Torah law, you have a place where there is no rabbinical court, and they need to appoint a wise person to follow human ethics. You just take somebody who's smart, somebody who's thoughtful, and he's going to use common sense. They may not accept the laws of the nations or establish their own laws. He says, better to take somebody who's just going to use common sense than to say, I'm going to follow whatever the laws of the land are and adopt them for my disputes. One who judges every case that comes before him as it appears to him is carrying out what is recognized as compromise. It does not appear that they have left the Torah, the source of living water, to excavate broken cisterns. But if they settle on laws, then again, it's an abandonment of the Torah, and the Chazon Ish doesn't like it. So what he wants is that you go to an arbitrator who's going to use common sense for it. There's more to be said about that. I rushed that obviously at the end, but I hope that answers the question, at least on a basic level, that one could go to ADR, although again, I think Rav Soloveitchik might look at it differently. I don't have any position from him on it, but I suspect that that might be true. Questions, comments?
33.
Yeah.
Which you left out.
Yes.
It says, Rabbi Federal, if anything accepts a non-Jewish judge, even form with that is nothing. What happens if the judge is Jewish? Even though it's in a
right, so having a Jew as a judge doesn't help you. Even if it's a Jewish judge, it doesn't matter. The point is not that it's not about the judge. It's about the system of justice. Yes, I understand, but that's not what he's talking about. The rule, it has nothing to do with the religion of the judge, and everything to do with the basis of law that the court is using. Yes.
We say Rav Soloveitchik might have been in favor of a non-halachic dispute resolution, since whatever promotes peace between the two parties would be din, in that sense.
Yeah. Effectively, yes. That's why I think, yeah. I'll even go you further, Moshe. Not everyone, but many authorities argue that the courts in Israel, secular courts in Israel, are also considered to be a secular court and a violation of Jewish law by going, even though the parties, the judges, and so on are Jewish, and the law is based even in many ways on Jewish law, they still don't accept it. So yeah, there's more to be said. Yes.
Going back to the reasons why you would want to go to a Basin versus a secular court, how does that, going back to the Rishalmi that you brought, where Shimon ben Shetach,
yes.
So that seems to, it's interesting, because that seems to imply that a Basin is not fit to judge Dini Mamanus.
Right. But the answer would be that he's talking on a practical level, not a philosophical level. You know, in other words, philosophically, you should be going to our courts and they should be judging cases. Practically, Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach says, yeah, but we're no good at this. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says it, analyzing right the loss of the ability to run those cases in the times of Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. Correct. I'm just, before I take Jules' question, just to note, if anyone needs to leave, they may. I will not be insulted, but do it quietly, please. But please make sure that you sign in, especially if you expect to get credit for it. I didn't have Elaine here to take pictures today, so I can't even verify that you were here based on a photograph. So please make sure that you sign in. Also, if you want the follow-up email in which I'm going to include some extra sources, please do so. I guess use the back. Or there's a third sheet. These are two sign-in sheets. There's a third one somewhere. Jewel, yes. Right. And the answer is true. Yeah, no, you're right. Corporations and right. Understood.
That's not quiet, sorry.